This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. What do the movies The Truman Show, Dead Poets Society, and Witness have in common? Yes, they're all well-known films that did well at the box office, and yes, they were all nominated for Academy Awards. You may not realize at first blush that they were all made by the same director. Peter Weir is also responsible for Green Card, Gallipoli, The Year of Living Dangerously, and The Mosquito Coast. Now into that disparate mix, he adds a nautical adventure set in the Napoleonic Wars, the film adaptation of Patrick O'Brien's novels Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World. It stars Russell Crowe, and it opens next week in theaters nationwide. This hour, a chance to find out more about this film and about those others. Director Peter Weir joins us in Studio 3A, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil. Nice to be here.
If you have a question for Peter Weir about his films, give us a call. Our number here is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And Peter Weir, I understand you originally turned down the opportunity to direct a film based on Patrick O'Brien's novels.
Yeah, that's true. It was offered to me in the summer in the 90s. I had read about four of the novels. It came from the Sam Goldwyn Company, which had it then, and it was literally the first book. We still carry the title, a little awkwardly.
Master and Commander.
Yes, I've used some elements from it, but really it's not at all a literal adaptation of that book. And it was the first in a series of 20, these magnificent books, and logically the starting place, you would think. However, the first book, I think, firstly, it was written as a one-off, almost journeyman job. He was hired to do it, and it was only at the end that he and his publisher felt there was much more in this, and indeed there was. And I think from the second book on, you might call, really, it a literature.
Mm.
But that first book, he's thrown everything but the kitchen sink in. Where I enjoyed it. It's a very enjoyable read. But we meet the key characters, but the captain's having a love affair with the admiral's wife, and there's an encounter with Corsican pirates, or Algerian pirates. And then Stephen Matcher spying on land, plus sea battles, and all the fun of the fair. And I thought if it was a literal adaptation, it would lend itself to parody, which is a danger in this genre.
Sure, be immediately dismissed as a swashbuckler.
Yes, and in fact, I did see a screenplay done at one point, and it was exactly that. Not even bad, but it was tongue-in-cheek, and, you know, Jack was a biggish man, and Stephen was a little man. It was a touch of the sort of Laurel and Hardy at sea.
Pirates in the Mediterranean, if you will.
It could have been. But anyway, I said thanks very much, but no, and read on. I then became, having reread these first few, which I'd not continued with, I read then through to the last volume, and unfortunately shortly after his death. And then it came to me, curiously, in 2000 again. And I'd had the pleasure of reading them without thinking about a movie. And again I turned it down for the same reasons and said, look, if anyone was crazy enough to do this, I think you'd start in the middle of the series, learn about this friendship. But what about one of the great long voyages that gave us so much pleasure? You know, something like The Far Side of the World, and get into that confined space of this small frigate and stay there for the picture.
That happens to be the 10th book, exactly halfway through the series.
Yeah. Exactly. I didn't think they'd say yes. You know, I thought it would, you know, they'd balk at that, but they did, and here we are.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned putting the film aboard this small ship in the middle of a big ocean. When Patrick O'Brien was on this program 8 years ago, he talked about the things that truly interested him in setting his universe, you know, on a 200-foot stage with you know, a few hundred souls in it. And here's what he had to say.
One of the things that I'm really concerned with is the nature of human relations, how they mature, how they develop. And a wooden box set afloat in a remote ocean in a either hostile atmosphere or a terribly hot one, or in shortage of food, shortage of water, brings all those things on much more rapidly, just as heat hastens chemical reactions. And if you're interested in human reactions, and that, I think, is the essence of writing novels, then that is a pretty good ambience in which to do it.
The essence of writing novels, perhaps, but some might argue that restricting yourself largely to this ship, and you're restricted pretty much largely to this ship in the movie, might not be a great formula for a movie.
Can I just say that was spooky? By God, hearing that man's voice coming right through my cans now, as if the living presence of O'Brien. Firstly, I loved what he said, and I in fact have that written down in my own kind of little book of what I think is the best of O'Brien. And that's what appealed to me immensely about the books, the relationships, and then in their little wooden box. And I felt that it was possible to make a film in which it would not become too claustrophobic for the audience, that it would not become too repetitive, mm-hmm. which was a danger. And enjoyed the challenge of, in fact, restricting my canvas just to that last statement he made, these people under intense pressure in very confined and brutal circumstances, and enjoying the relationships, you know, both the positive and negative turns that they take, and the surprising humanity that is within these simple people and reflected in his books.
Do you feel that one advantage you had over him, though, is you would occasionally pull back and show us this little wooden box afloat on this vast ocean, and we could, again, gain some perspective on it?
Yes, it's it's interesting what you win and lose as you adapt a book. I mean, it's a remarkably different medium. Because we have the screenplay as the sort of intermediate stage, mm-hmm. I think people tend to think that it's much more literal than it really is. I think opera is probably closer. Music, make music out of the book. Films are incredibly cartoonish in a way, that we get very sort of different sort of language to the book. And the first thing I lose as I make the adaptation is the prose, the beautiful prose of O'Brien. And I have to replace that with my language, which is the language of the image. And there are times where, yes, I do have an advantage over him. When I show a young midshipman, he can say a young midshipman, mm-hmm. and you read that and go on. But to see the fresh face of someone like young Max Perkis, who mm-hmm. plays the 13-year-old midshipman on board, and hold on a close-up, that's my power, the ability that I have in this medium. But then when it comes to some of his descriptions, I puzzle as to how to equal them.
Our phone number again is 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's start off with Pat, who's on the line with us from Atlanta in Georgia.
Mr. Weir, I have read the Time magazine article mm-hmm. about the movie. And in a sidebar, they say that you have not given all the characteristics that O'Brien gives to Stephen Maturin, which to my mind is I've read all of the books twice and will without doubt read them a third time, which seems to me a shame if that is true. Maturin turns out, to be even a more interesting character in his own way than Jack Aubrey.
He's the author, you attempted to say, really. I think there's a lot of O'Brien in him. Friends who knew him say that. It was fine piece in Time and Photographs and part of all the kind of, sort of trumpet voluntary before the film opens. But that was really, I thought, possibly someone who hadn't seen the film, because Paul Bettany has done a wonderful job with Dr. Maturin. And that's reflected in all of the early reviews and reviews that you will come to read. That he holds his own with a very powerful actor.
When I go to the movie, I won't come out shaking my head and say nasty.
No, you might. You might shake your head in the first few minutes because, it's not physically. I didn't go for this extremely slim. What was he? 125-pound man with a sort of bad wig, and dirty clothes. This is where you need. Experience in making an adaptation. If I had taken Maturin as he is literally to the screen, physically, I would patronize him. He would come across as somewhat eccentric and sort of the audience, I rather would patronize him.
The biggest change is he's presented in the books, as you mentioned in the first book. He is an espionage agent as well as as a physician and a surgeon who's on the ship. And that aspect of his role is not brought out in this particular story.
That's quite true. I mean, it's essentially a 5,000-page-plus novel. It's episodic, as any reader of the books knows, and it's impossible in a two-hour film to present all of that material. But I believe that, and O'Brien fans who have seen the film so far are very happy. Now, that won't be all. You know, no film pleases everybody. But if I can just say to you, madam, that it was made with intense affection for O'Brien's work. Nevertheless, I must sail my own boat and make my own decisions as captain of the film. And those decisions, you know, you'll approve of or not. But I hope you enjoy it.
Well, thanks.
I'll go and make up my own mind.
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah. Pat, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Let's go to Tor, and Tor is with us from Northampton, Massachusetts.
Hi.
Hey.
Hi. I'm a longtime O'Brien fan, and I've read the promotional book that the movie company has put out, mm-hmm. and even though you've obviously made a lot of you've done what you had to do, I'm very excited about the upcoming movie, but I wish you could describe again the decision to make the Norfolk, the American ship, into a French ship.
Let me just explain. In the novel, Far Side of the World is set in 1812, during the War of 1812. The long chase involved in the film was with an American frigate, the Norfolk, and in your film, Peter Weir, you switch it to 1805, mm-hmm. when obviously mm-hmm. the Americans were not at war with the British, and change the ship to a French ship, the Acheron.
Exactly. I mean, fortunately, O'Brien did not write for the movies. Therefore, plot is not his primary aim. It is relationships, and it is creating a valid and real world. If you, you know, apart from fanatics, you know, an average fan, if you, you know, said, give me the plot of Reverse of the Medal, you have 30 seconds. not many will recall it, but they will recall Maturin and so on. And so what I felt was the War of 1812 was a dirty little war in which the British, you know, come out of it very badly. If I'd made it that way, it would, you know, the American ship would have, you know, based on Captain Porter's Essex, would have been the victim of a really persecution on the part of Jack. Again, the literalness of the movie. Mm-hmm. The British would be seen as the villains, and it would be confusing.
Okay.
O'Brien himself wished he'd started the series earlier, if he'd known how successful and how much, you know, material he had,
sure.
to stay within the Napoleonic Wars.
Uh-huh.
So I felt 1805 was better, and given the plots are somewhat arbitrary,
sure.
that it was better to involve it, you know, as a British-French action, essentially, between two ships, made her a French privateer to get away from exactly what the French Navy was fleet was doing with the Spanish, and make it O'Brien-esque.
Okay.
Thanks for the call, Tor.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, let's hear a clip from the movie. This is a scene in which Stephen Maturin, played by Paul Bettany, questions Russell Crowe's Jack Aubrey about the wisdom of continuing what he regards as the mad pursuit of the French ship Acheron.
You're not accustomed to defeat. And chasing this larger, faster ship with its long guns is beginning to smack of pride.
It's not a question of pride or anything like it. It's a question of duty.
Duty? Right, yes, I believe I've heard it well spoken of.
Well, you can be as satiric as you like. Viewing the world through your microscope is your prerogative. This is a ship of war, and I will grind whatever grist the mill requires in order to fulfill my duty.
Whatever the cost?
Whatever the cost.
An excerpt from the new film Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, and we just have 30 seconds or so before we have to go to the break, but Bettany and Russell Crowe acting there, of course they were the mm-hmm. same team in A Beautiful Mind.
That's so.
Best
yeah.
friends. That picture and
exactly.
this one. We're discussing with director Peter Weir his new film Master and Commander, starring Russell Crowe and Paul Bettany. When we come back, we're going to talk with him about some of his other films, which include The Truman Show, Dead Poets Society, and The Year of Living Dangerously. Though, if you have questions about Master and Commander, feel free to call up with those as well. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address, if you'd like to send us questions that way, is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Back after a break, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our guest today, and we're privileged, is movie director Peter Weir. His new film is called Master and Commander. It's out in theaters next week. If you'd like to join our conversation, the phone number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And Mr. Weir, the film comes out at a moment when the United States is involved in a war in Iraq, and you can't put this movie outside of the larger context in which we're in. Jack Aubrey, as we heard in the clip we just heard before the break, is a man who's unconflicted about his role in a very different conflict in a very different century. Mm-hmm. Do you fear that this is going to be seen as a pro-war movie?
Oh, I would hope not. I mean, firstly, Brian's books, in which this is firmly based, were written at another time themselves, in the 30-year period from the 70s onwards, the 20 books. But on the other hand, I understand people are looking for signs, looking for clues, or imagery becomes redolent, and a phrase becomes significant. But I think it would be wrong to attribute that to myself. Given, in a sense, at least here, right this minute, I am the film.
Mm-hmm.
There was no, naturally, no agenda. But you do pick up things as it goes through the time, and then you can lose them. And if the film survives, interesting, having looked at some of my earlier films, they can pick something up, iron filings to a magnet at a certain period, perhaps when it came out. Then, as the film goes on, they drop off, and they might pick up other things, and have another meaning later on, if the film is strong enough to deserve a second, third, fourth viewing.
Mm-hmm.
So you just have to live that out.
Many people will be drawing comparisons to Gallipoli, which was another war movie, and this is very firmly an anti-war movie. Let's listen to a clip from this. It's a story of two Australians who fight in a particularly bloody battle in the First World War, the Allied assault at Gallipoli, where they felt betrayed by the British officers who were in charge, who they felt were callous in spending their lives. The character, played by a young Mel Gibson, is reluctant to join up in the first place. Here's a scene where he argues with the character played by Mark Lee.
You of all people should be going.
Why me of all people?
Because you're an athlete.
What's that got to do with it?
I've got mates who'd be lucky to run the 112, and they're going to do their bit. So why shouldn't you?
Because it's not our bloody war.
What do you mean, not our war?
It's an English war. It's got nothing to do with it.
Anyways, you are. You're a bloody coward.
And I guess, Peter Weir, the question that comes up is, again, those soldiers are they would feel betrayed by English officers in charge at Gallipoli, and yet here you are celebrating an English officer only 100 years earlier.
Mm. Well, I think, the incidents are very different, the war is very different. And I think that, while you can see certain, you can say, as some do, that this in some way sort of is synchronous with what's going on. I can't really see it myself. I do think you can, learn about leadership. You can reflect on the past. What is history for us, really, but to help us understand the present? And so to that extent, it's interesting. But what's difficult about your question is that I so completely sunk myself back into that time. I used to joke with my crew and say that we're the Admiralty Film Unit. We're going back in time to make a recruiting film or something. We get caught up in this incident. Imagine if they had the camera then. Our research, our detailing. I have been outside of our world. You can't miss the headlines, and you can't, help but be torn with pain at what is going on from time to time, this year particularly. But the film itself was another world, and I created that and made it true to itself. Any conclusions people want to make, from that world to this, anything they gain, positive or negative, it will be their own choice and observation. But as far as I'm concerned, it really was a slice of life from that period, and, via O'Brien.
Let's get some more listeners involved. Yeah. Again, the number is 800-989-8255. And Robert joins us from Manhattan in New York.
Hello, Mr. Weir.
Hi.
And, great honor to speak with you. I'm a very, very big fan of your work. And I wanted to ask you about... And just generally thank you for two of the movies you made, because they've been two of the movies that are two of my favorites and have stuck with me for years, which is Picnic at Hanging Rock and The Last Wave. Mm. And I wanted to ask you about those films in terms of, is there something sort of intrinsically sort of an Australian surrealism or something, that's attached to those films? They're so diffuse, and they have this quality of dread that is very different from the work that you sort of in quotes the Hollywood work you've done, the sort of more high profile films. So I've always wondered, do you think you're tapping into something that's intrinsically Australian or something about with those films?
I can't say entirely, you know, it's a tricky question, an interesting question, but, you know, I think I'm many things before I'm an Australian. I mean, in other words, I think nationality is interesting, but I don't think it's significant, certainly not in the world I live in. You know, that is the world of storytelling and, you know, a life spent doing that on the screen. Mm-hmm. I think that, firstly, in terms of, you know, saying the Hollywood work, I've never made any distinction between, you know, Australian or Hollywood work. You know, really, when you're on the set, you know, wherever you are, including Los Angeles, it's the set. And in that period, you know, I've made some big films, some small ones that became big. You know, Fearless that I made in the 90s was by no means, you know, a typical Hollywood film with Jeff Bridges. And in fact did not find an audience. Mosquito Coast and so on. But in other words, I think really my trade is a storyteller. And I will use whatever tools are necessary for that particular story. And so with Last Wave and Picnic, yes, I was somewhat interested in, you know, there's a thematic link in a way between them, you know, the kind of, you know, the what lies beyond the tangible real world we live in. I was interested in my own reading at the time, but I did use tools to help tell those stories that were appropriate to them. You know, take Picnic, it doesn't have an ending. You know, it's a mystery without a solution. So in the telling of the tale, I had to prepare the audience to not expect that solution, or they'd be, you know, very upset. Well, who did it? And in doing that, I used the tools, you know, including a surrealistic somewhat approach and a kind of eeriness about it, so that I'd prepare them for, you know, to think, not only will there not be an answer, but I don't really want one. Mm-hmm. And the film became about something else. But, you know, essentially, I carry a bag of tools on my back and you know, and they rattle and clank and I go from job to job, you know, along the highway and tell the next tale and then move on somewhere else.
Well, Rob, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Robert.
Bye-bye.
Let's go now to Jamie, and Jamie's in Medford, Oregon.
Yes. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Mr. Weir, this may be a small thing, but it regards your craft. One of your favorite movies that I liked was, one of my favorite movies that you did was The Year of Living Dangerously.
Mm-hmm.
There was a character in there played by the actress Linda Hunt, but she played a man.
Right.
Did you have any difficulties in directing her? And if so, maybe you could explain a little bit of the circumstances, if that was the case.
Certainly unusual circumstances and never repeated and not recommended. I just simply couldn't find an actor who fitted the description of the character. I had tried someone and it didn't work out, and sets were being built. Mel was hired. We were starting in Manila. And so I was looking for an Asian-Australian cameraman, 5 feet high, you know, just nearly a dwarf. And I couldn't get it right. You couldn't find someone who was Asian and short or short, you know, who would in any way fit the description. And my casting director said, look, what about this person? Showed me a photograph of Linda, covered the hair, and the description was terrific. The height was pretty right. Terrific acting experience, and then he laughed and said, ha ha, it's a woman. Anyway, we did meet her in New York, and she was wonderful. We got on straight away. She said, could you rewrite it for a woman? I said, not in 1965, it wouldn't be credible. And it was meant to be in Jakarta. I said, could you play a man? And she said, well, without it being part of the plot, I don't know. Anyway, long story short, we got very good makeup, and she worked on it. And she just said to me, you know, when we set off on this project, she said, Peter, can I only ask you one thing, which is that you will never doubt that I can do it. If I see doubt in your eyes, she said, I just won't be able to get through. Anyway, she did a wonderful job, and as chance would have it, she won the Academy Award that the next year for you know, supporting actor.
Yes, indeed.
And
actress.
Actress. Why do you say it's an experience never to be repeated?
Well, there was nothing to be gained from the plot. It wasn't like a, you know, some sort of crying game revelation. Mm-hmm. And everything to be lost, you know, it would really just seem just to be bizarre and an effect that might harm your enjoyment of the story, really, if you felt something was odd about the casting.
Yeah, if you dismissed as a stunt.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Jamie, thanks very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Okay. Here's an email question we got from Tony Lash in Portland, Oregon. Please talk about Fearless. Having gone through a near-death experience, this film changed my life and helped me deal with the extreme emotions involved in the event. I was amazed how well Mr. Weir handled this delicate material.
Oh, what a nice thing to say. And I can only refer immediately to my research period, where, you know, given this was based on a real aircraft accident, a DC-10 accident at Sioux City, Iowa, in which half of the people survived and unfortunately half did not. And I had planned, you know, we had scenes of the actual accident planned, storyboards drawn and so on. And around this time I began to speak to, took a long time to get to them, understandably, survivors from the accident who would talk to me. So I had about four or five people and rang them up in a couple of different places in the country. And they said, oh, well, Hollywood never gets it right, you know, this kind of thing. And I said, well, tell me, help me get it right. And it was their descriptions, more trust, gave me more information, and I could ask more difficult questions as we got to know each other in subsequent calls. And I shaped the entire accident aspect of this according to their experiences. So, for example, there were no exterior shots because they couldn't see, obviously, outside the aircraft body. And if it was in slow motion, that's because someone had told me it was slow motion. If someone touched someone's hand, that was because that's what someone told me. And so I rooted it in the experience of, you know, that you had unfortunately survived.
Another email question. This is from Rick Becker in Mineral Springs, North Carolina. No interview with Peter Weir would be complete without a discussion of the early film The Plumber. Please speak briefly with Mr. Weir about this amazing film if you can. I confess I have not seen it.
It was made for television, so that's somebody who's really hunted it out. It was based on a story told to me by friends in London, a couple who had experienced aspects of this story. I mean, not literally the same, but certainly an invasive plumber who the wife began to doubt was really a plumber, all on a university campus. So it was university accommodation. And the tension that grew then between she and her husband was all literally part of the story told to me.
And this was when in your career?
It was just after I'd done The Last Wave, so it was late 70s.
So fairly early on.
Yeah.
And still based in Australia at that time.
That's right. Shot for television. It was part of a series of telemovies.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with movie director Peter Weir. His new film is Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, starring Russell Crowe. It opens at a theater near you, as they say, next week. We're also talking about some of his other movies, including Picnic at Hanging Rock and Witness and Green Card. You can join the conversation, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from NPR News. An earlier film, even than The Plumber, is The Cars That Ate Paris. And this one we did find a video of, and let me just play a clip from it here. It's from 1974, a story about the small town of Paris, Australia, where the residents cause car accidents by outsiders going through the town and then salvage their cars. One outsider, Arthur, survives the crash he was involved in. Here we hear the mayor of the town convincing Arthur to stay to keep the town's secret.
What I would like you to do is I would like you to settle here permanently and become part of our family, part of my family.
That means I stay with your family.
That's right.
Okay. I never had a real family.
There's one thing that close families don't do. They don't talk to outsiders. They keep themselves to themselves.
A clip from the Cars That Ate Paris.
Long time ago. I just saw Terry Camilleri, who played the Arthur, the fellow who was caught in the trap, which it essentially was. This town was a trap. And I saw him at a screening of my current film the other night. We stay in touch.
Let's get another caller in. Jamie joins us from Wilson, North Carolina.
Hello.
Hi, Jamie. You're on the air.
Thank you. First of all, Mr. Weir, I love your movies, really appreciate your artistic talent.
Thank you.
And I just wondered if you knew that I'm a teacher. I've been teaching in the Middle East for the last 8 years and teaching graduate students, and I use your movies to teach values that I can't otherwise explain.
Wow, that's...
Yes, particularly Witness and Dead Poets Society, and... I've kept a journal over the years of the impact of those movies on these future leaders of Islamic communities, if you can believe that.
No, I mean, what, this is the most extraordinary thing I've heard. I mean, do they have, you know, given it's from such a different culture, that's part, of, obviously, of what you're doing. They can, you know, see common and shared points of view?
Absolutely. And, you know, like I would show the movie Witness, and they immediately recognize the cultural implications of an outsider coming in and maintaining tradition, and yet the need for change. And I have stacks of papers they've written about these movies. That's just...
Good heavens. What age are the students?
Graduate level.
Hmm.
So 20s, early 30s, from completely closed education systems where I'm not allowed to, you know, give any particular ideological view.
Mm,
I just pop in the movie, and that does it.
So what did they think of The Cars That Ate Paris?
I didn't use that one.
No.
That one I didn't use.
You're choosing carefully.
But I really appreciate your work, and I just,
Thank you.
Sometimes people don't realize the extent of what they've done. If you ever want to read these, let me know.
Thank you very much. Do you still teach there? Can you still teach?
Actually, I'm heading back to our latest war-torn Islamic country next week, and I'm taking them with me.
Well, you've taken my breath away, and I just can only say wish you every success and bridging the enormous gulf between our different peoples. God, amazing.
Well, it just shows you the incredible power of the arts.
That's true. That's true. Absolutely. Mm.
And sometimes in very surprising areas, Jamie.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jamie, good luck wherever it is you're going.
Mm, absolutely.
Thank you.
And continue the good work. We're going to
continue.
Yeah. We're talking with filmmaker Peter Weir. His new movie is an adaptation of Patrick O'Brien's novels. It's called Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World. We're going to continue our conversation after a short break. Here are some of the stories NPR News is working on this afternoon. President Bush signed legislation today banning a certain type of abortion that gave opponents of the controversial procedure a long-sought victory. A federal judge at least partially blocked the new law from taking effect. And the suspected Green River Killer admitted to 48 murders today in a courtroom in Seattle, Washington. The list of his victims is so long it took Gary Ridgway 8 minutes to plead guilty to all of the counts against him. Ridgway will be sentenced to life in prison without the chance of parole. You can hear details on those stories later today on All Things Considered. Talk of the Nation and our conversation with Peter Weir continues after a short break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're discussing with director Peter Weir the many films he's made, from The Truman Show, Witness, and The Cars That Ate Paris. Of course, his new movie is Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World. And let's go right to another phone call. This is Scott, who's with us from Oakland, California.
Good day, gentlemen. How are you?
Very fine,
well.
Scott.
Good. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask you, Mr. Weir, about music in your films. How much control do you exercise over the music that's played in your films? For example, in Gallipoli, I noticed you had Jean-Michel Jarre doing some music.
That's right. Yeah, well, I can't say total control, you know, when I've hired a wonderful composer. Not that I hired Jean-Michel Jarre for that. Sometimes I'll buy source music, as it's called, music you've used, while I've been cutting. And that was the case with that piece from Oxygen that played throughout that, a number of times in that film. In fact, I threw the whole score out. It just didn't work. And bought source music. And that had happened, you know, Picnic at Hanging Rock. I had the pan pipes of George Zamfir
right
there and bought those. So I'll often buy, literally off disc or CD.
In Master and Commander, one of the bonding elements of the friendship between Stephen Maturin and Jack Aubrey is their love of music, and they play. Thanks for the call, Scott. They play duets. Maturin on the cello and Aubrey scrapes away at the violin, as he likes to say. This gave you a natural moment and a natural frame for the music you use in that movie.
Quite so. And as I wrote the script, I had the pleasure over that long year of working with John Colley, my co-writer, of listening to hundreds of CDs from the period. Of course, many of them, the list we had mentioned in the books. And finally came to choose those pieces with Richard Tognetti, who did the cabin music.
Mm-hmm.
And it helped me get back into the period. It's amazing. I'm very susceptible to music. I think it's like I don't quite know how to describe it, but it helps me make films. And what I play in the preparation, sometimes I play during the shoot, not always.
I'm told you play music very loudly during the shoot sometimes.
Hopefully loudly enough. I don't like to play music if I feel it will inhibit anybody and get in the way of the actors. I'll sometimes use it, again, as a tool, you know, so that, let's say, a scene isn't quite working, or I'll say, just listen to this piece of music. It seems to have something of the feeling in it. Why don't you just do a take one? I'll keep the music playing, you know, make it less self-conscious. Other times, you know, as in action scenes, particularly in this last film, again, a self-consciousness amongst extras, and, you know, there's all the equipment and crew around, and it doesn't look very real. I'll put on a piece of music with all of the power and force and energy of the action, and have them and roll the cameras with the music playing. And inevitably, anybody, you know, from professionals to amateurs, will respond to that and pick up the mood.
We have some excerpts of the music that you no, you don't. No, we don't. We thought we did, but we don't.
I thought we did. Hum something.
Okay, well, let's meanwhile go to another caller. And this is Cherie, who joins us in Tahoe City, California.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, I wanted to ask Peter a question about Dead Poets Society, which is one of my very favorite films. And I would like you to talk about, if you would, there's a very intense scene in there between Robin Williams and Ethan Hawke when Ethan Hawke's character is asked to come up in front of the classroom and improvise a poem.
Mm.
And I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, I remember being there that day and just watched with great pleasure as these two actors did the scene. You know, I couldn't be in the room because we were using a Steadicam camera. That is, the camera was floating around the actors and therefore seeing into every corner of the room, including the students sitting there. And I just loved the work that they both did. I do remember a couple of critics saying that, or people who'd seen it saying that he was, the teacher was very hard on the boy, you know, what they call sort of tough love. Not a phrase I'm overly fond of, but I know the meaning of that. And they thought, they criticized the character, not Robin's acting, as going too far with the boy to push him to overcome his shyness and his fear that he was using as a sort of shield, because Robin, as you know, sensed the boy had poetry in him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I rejected the criticism, but I thought they both did a wonderful job, and all I can say is it was all their own work.
Hmm. We don't have that scene particularly queued up, Cherie, but we do have a scene where Robin Williams, as John Keating, encourages his students to think for themselves. An early moment in the film, Keating's response to an introduction to the boys' poetry textbook.
Excrement. That's what I think of Mr. J. Evans Pritchard. We're not laying pipe. We're talking about poetry. How can you describe poetry like American Bandstand? Well, I like Byron. I give him a 42, but I can't dance to it. Now, I want you to rip out that page. Go on. Rip out the entire page. You heard me. Rip it out. Rip it out!
That's a wonderful scene that people remember fondly from Dead Poets Society. Cherie, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you for taking me.
Sure. Let's go to Miranda, and Miranda's in San Francisco. Hello, Miranda, are you there?
Yes, I am. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
I am fascinated by the fact, one fact about Witness, which is such an incredible film, and the thing that struck me about it is there's very little dialogue in that movie, and the images, therefore, are extremely powerful, and one in particular hangs in my mind over the years like as though it were a painting on a museum wall. It's like a Dutch painting where it opens in a room where a man is lying in bed. He just opens his eyes. There's a woman sitting beside him in a chair, and he looks up at this array of very serious, silent men who look like Judgment Day. Nothing is said, and I can't, you know, it has a biblical quality, it has such a power, and although I'm in love with words, since I'm a poet myself, I can never forget this, the power of that graphic image.
That's very evocatively described. You took me back, Miranda. And we did, my cameraman and I did indeed study. There was a great exhibition of Dutch masters and Flemish masters at the period we were making it.
Interesting.
Which we went to and studied Holbein and went up to New York at the Metropolitan to analyze the quality of the light. And as far as the lack of words, you know, I think they should be used when they count. But, you know, it is primarily, you know, to state the obvious, a visual medium. You know what helped me too, I think, in my early years in Australia? We couldn't write dialogue. And consequently, you were always cutting lines, you know, because not only could we not write it very well, but people couldn't say it very well. You know, actors were were really learning the trade as we were learning the trade of directing or writing. And so, you know, in the end, you'd say, just do it in a look, you know, and so I think it was probably great training.
Well, the power of graphics, I sometimes hate to admit the power.
Oh, well, we need them both, the words and the whatever is best serves the expression of the idea.
Yeah. Well,
and I love poetry, so. Yeah.
And what I do in my poetry is create image after image after image.
That's a wonderful thing. Yes. Just as you know, have the power of the spoken word to evoke that memory of the detective lying on the bed and the faces of the old Amish people.
Yes. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Miranda.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Before we let you go, we've gotten several people who called to ask whether this adaptation of Patrick O'Brien's book would be, whether there might be followed by others, and you certainly leave it. It's an episodic movie, and it leads almost in mid-episode, really. It ends. I don't want to give away the ending, but it ends kind of in mid-episode. And it's interesting, you mentioned earlier that his first book, Master and Commander, was a one-off. When he was on this program, I asked him about that, and he corrected me. He said, no, if you read the last scene, he says, I certainly hope when he's appearing before the court martial, I hope your sword can be raised again in the defense of England. And it was always seen as a great long series. I'm not sure that he was entirely honest about that.
No, but who knows?
Is this the first of a series of films?
Well, you know, I'm probably in the position that Brian was in. I mean, he could then, you know, say that he did plan it, looking back over 20 of 19 volumes. For me, well, firstly, it's an economic question. The film would have to make an enormous sum of money. It wasn't cheap, that's for sure. Any time of boats and water. And secondly, I'm not entirely sure I would personally set sail again. I mean, if someone else could do it. I've so enjoyed this, and it has been wonderful and difficult. Quite an experience. But I think it may be an experience to have once, and for me, perhaps to look for something fresh and new.
We'll look forward to it, whatever it is. Peter Weir, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Neil.
Peter Weir is the director of many films, including the just-about-to-be-released Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World.